Blog Talk Radio.
Just in time. There with the infamous Fogs Bean Squeak. We've been using it ever since we got it. Thanks, Fogs, for all the cool stuff you've done for us. And welcome, good old Bob, GGSI Paper. We got a full house tonight so far as we celebrate the birthday of Gail Gordon. I'm Dale Kay from Spook Show here along with
Dave Bigley from Weirdest Really Bad Movie and Spaceship One. And we are also here with
I forgot.
Who am I?
Garvin Gold. Maybe.
We'll give you a hint. It starts with G.
Yeah. Let's
start with a G and ends with starts with a G and ends with an AR. Yeah.
Now let's just start over. Open the creaking door again.
Nah, it's live.
No do overs. Many times we should have done a do over, but we can't. It's live.
That's right.
No do overs.
Here we go with what we got. And we got some good Gail Gordon stuff as we celebrate his, I don't know, kajillionth birthday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I meant to pull it up, but I didn't. Let me.
I am too. I'm scrambling now. February 20th, 1906. So actually, his birthday is Sunday.
Yes.
And he would be.
But we're celebrating the whole weekend for him.
116.
Yes.
Mm hmm.
He died in 1995.
I don't think he'll complain.
No.
Yeah. That's right. If Gail Gordon were alive today, he'd be dead.
Probably. Passed away in 1995 on June 30th. But did a lot in between as we cover some of it. Gosh, I did not know until we were doing this, Dave, that you could call him Gail Flash Gordon.
Yes. He was the very first Flash Gordon. He happened to be in New York at the time, and there was a bunch of people auditioning for it. He only stayed for the first 10 episodes. But I don't know. And we'll have an episode, I think, tomorrow? I think we got tomorrow an episode.
Yes,
of
tomorrow
Flash
we have
Gordon.
Flash Gordon.
I didn't pick the first one because he wasn't as prominent in that episode as he was in this one. But it is an episode that Flash Gordon is definitely in. But yeah, he was an early radio, and we'll get to hear that. And we also have a bunch of interview segments with Chuck Shaden out of Chicago, and it was a telephone interview, and we'll learn so much about not only about Gail Gordon, but about early radio and all the roles he had. And this guy virtually worked from the time he started in radio. Even during this phone call, he actually is getting ready to go up to Canada to do like a play. He's going to do a play, and it's just amazing. This guy always had some work. It's just absolutely amazing.
Yeah,
it's weird. He started in radio documented that they still have the file 1932 in Tarzan of the Apes, but there's some stuff before that, and they don't have a date. For it. 32.
Wow.
And but those were serials on the radio as well, so they're probably there, yeah.
Yeah. For something like Captains of Industry he was in, and not before. Go ahead.
He'd have been only 26 then in 32. So, yeah, but yeah.
His last name was
Aldridge. So many cool things.
I don't know why he changed his stage name to Gordon, but his last name was Aldridge. It was probably the fact that he was a junior. You always want to get away from that. Where's Rob Smith Jr.? Hey, Junior, get away from that.
Yep, not only being on a few guest appearances in the original I Love Lucy, naturally he went on to Here's Lucy, and other adaptations of the show.
Mr. Mooney is my strongest memory.
I forgot he had played a character on Visit to a Small
Planet. That would be the show that we grew up with. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But he worked with Lucille Ball back on My Favorite Husband. And when she did I Love Lucy, she wanted Gail Gordon to be in there. She actually wanted him to be the part that William Frawley got. But the fact is,
right.
he was locked into a contract with Artemus Brooks, both on radio and then on television as well. So he was not able to join her, although he does talk about a couple of other shows that he did with her, and he did appear on a couple of Lucy segments. But
I'm surprised Desi Arnaz didn't get a little jealous as much contact as they had. Don't know if there's anything
Desi
ever
Arnaz,
going on between those two.
Desi Arnaz loved
yeah.
what worked, and Gail
oh,
Gordon was a perfect foil for Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
I had forgotten he had been in two movies I really like, and he played pretty good roles in them, in The 30-Foot Bride of Candy Rock and also Visit to a Small Planet with Jerry
okay,
Lewis.
Okay, yeah.
So in just 2 years, he got to work with Lou Costello and Jerry Lewis.
Hey, while we are bringing up some stuff, why don't you play one of those first clips there, Dale, of Gail Gordon in the interview with Chuck Shaden.
All right.
Just to get a taste of Gail Gordon.
All right. Here we go with part one as we have it. We'll be back shortly.
You're listening to Old Time Radio Classics here on WBBM News Radio 78 Chicago. I'm Chuck Shaden, and we're delighted to have with us on the line from Borrego Springs, California, Mr. Gail Gordon. Hello, Gail.
Hello, how are you?
I'm delighted to have you with us this evening.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
You are really one of the most durable supporting actors from radio and television for, gosh, must be over 60 years. Is that correct?
I've been in this business for 67 years, yes. 1923 I started.
My goodness. Now, what did you do in 1923? What were you doing?
I was in a play in New York on Broadway with Richard Bennett, who was the father of Joan, Constance, and Barbara Bennett. And that was the start of my career. I was 17 years old, and I've been working in the theater or television or radio ever since.
You haven't really paused to stop at all, have you?
I've been lucky enough to work for 67 years.
Incredible. Now, you've been out of the country for a while, haven't you?
Well, every year I go to Canada to do dinner theater. The last 13 years I've been going up there every year. We're going again in September to open another theater for the Stage West people, and I love it. I love the theater, of course. And keeps me active and out of mischief, and I love that.
Well, we love all the work you've been doing over the years. Now, we, of course, on this program, like to concentrate on the good old days of radio.
Yes.
And how did you get into radio, and when did you get into radio?
Well, that was in the early 1930s, and radio was a sort of a novelty in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly out here in California, we were very behind the times as far as initiating radio programs and so forth are concerned. And I was out of a job, and somebody said, well, call up the radio station, and, you know, you might do that. It's easy work. You read from a piece of paper. You don't have to memorize lines or anything and put on makeup or get dressed up in costumes and so forth. And I called KFWB here in Hollywood, and a young lady answered, and on the phone said, well, come in tomorrow at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'll talk to you. And I went down the next day at 10 o'clock to this little tiny office. There was a lady walking around. She was answering the phones, and she was doing all kinds of things. There was nobody else in the place at all. And I sat there for about half an hour, and finally she came over and said, well, may I ask what you're doing here? And I said, well, I'm waiting for an interview with Miss Kay Van Riper. She said, well, I'm Kay Van Riper. And well, I talked to you on the phone yesterday, and you said to come in at 10 o'clock. And she looked at me. I was then 26 or 27. She said, oh, from your voice, I thought you were a middle-aged Englishman. And so she said, yes, I have a part for you, and I did a radio show with her as an English character in some sort of a playlet that she had written. And I was with her for several years doing all kinds of things. But that was my start in radio, for which I got $2.50. And the station took out 25 cents for employing me. So that was not very lucrative, but that was the going rate in California in those days.
The station acted as your agent, in effect. Is that right?
All the agents, all the stations in California acted as agents when they called anyone to act. They took 10% out of the $250 that they paid you anyway.
Did that all change when the union came about, AFRA?
Well, it changed, yes, a good deal, but then it was against the law, actually, for an employer to hire you and then take percent as your aid, take 10%, because that isn't kosher, no matter how you look at it. And the studios did it for years and years and years, and finally, of course, it was outlawed, and we got more than $2.50 finally out here. We got $5. I wasn't allowed to work at one station because I asked for $3 for a show, and they thought I was too stuck up and much too expensive, and they wouldn't hire me.
We'll have more of the interview with Gail Gordon from Doug Shaden.
It's so much about early radio, not only how he got in, but the fact is they took out a percentage. And I think I'd seen or heard that somewhere before, but as they employed them, they took out a percentage and kept it for themselves. It was just what a strange
that radio was.
That's the way it was.
Go ahead. That's a shady business there.
Yeah,
that's so shady. Hey, let's give you how about $500, but we're going to take $450, okay? You'll like that.
Yeah. Right? 500, yeah. Wait, what?
And one wouldn't hire him because he wanted $3 for the show.
Yeah.
So what would $3 in 1935?
Okay, 1935,
or what would $2.50?
Right?
$2.50 in 1935, what would that be?
He's garculating. I'm
working on it.
It's overheating.
I know.
It's overheating. There you go.
Oh, hell.
It was overheating, yeah.
Yeah. 1935?
1935,
$3?
Yeah, let's go with 1935.
Somebody step on a goat.
$3. No goats here. It'd be $61.57, according to 8 people in Saginaw.
Where is Saginaw?
Okay.
It's in Michigan,
so
I think, but I could be wrong. There might be one in Pittsburgh. I don't know.
So is that Saginaw, Wisconsin, or Saginaw, Michigan?
Both.
Oh, okay. Totally.
Yeah. Okay. We're really easy here at Erie House. We'll take both, sure. So $3.35 would have been $61.57. So, this is kind of wild if you think about. Remember, Orson Welles and I can't think of it. Endora, no, what's her name?
Yeah, Agnes.
They were getting in. They were getting in cabs and they were going all over the place. They were making $3 a pop, so they were making a couple hundred bucks per day. Doing that bounce around. If they're getting paid.
Yeah, remember, Orson Welles would hire an ambulance to take him from one studio to
the next. That's right. Yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
And he'd throw Agnes in the back, and woo, they were off. Yeah, so.
Agnes Moorhead, yeah.
You
yep.
made that sound dirty.
Yeah.
Anyway.
What?
We got a lot of radio.
A lot of radio.
Yep, a lot of Gail Gordon as we celebrate his birthday. What do you think we start with some Gregory Hood?
Yeah,
we
it's the
that.
Darkest we
sure.
got. It's the darkest
yeah,
we got.
It's one of the few roles where we get to hear him be the lead character. We'll have another one tomorrow, but we got this one tonight. And good old Gregory Hood. I liked it. I have a story I'm going to tell in the middle of this, how he lost his gig. But we'll do that at the midpoint.
Yeah,
okay.
This one is called The Murder of Gregory Hood. Ooh, from the casebook of.
Yeah.
And what's their original broadcast date on this? Anybody know?
June 17th, 1946.
You betcha.
Petri Wine brings you The Casebook of Gregory Hood. Tonight, the Petri family, the family that took time to bring you good wine, invite you to listen to the story of The Murder of Gregory Hood, another exciting adventure from The Casebook of Gregory Hood. And while you're sitting back listening to our story, how about enjoying a glass of America's favorite wine, port wine? Port is America's favorite wine, and you'll know why when you try your first glass of Petri California Port. Petri Port is a deep, deep red. And when you hold Petri Port up to the light, you can practically see through the glass. That's because Petri Port is so clear, one sure sign of a good wine. But the way Petri Port tastes is what really counts. And I can tell you, it's so delicious, you want to sip it slowly, so you won't miss a single drop of that marvelous Petri flavor. And you'll want to serve Petri Port to your friends, too, after dinner or any time they drop in for a visit. And naturally, you can serve Petri Port proudly, because those letters P-E-T-R-I spell the proudest name in the long history of fine wine. It's Monday night in San Francisco, and we have a date with Gregory Hood. A little earlier, Gregory phoned me to say that he was working late at his office, so let's join him there, shall we?
Come in. Hello, Harry.
Evening, Gregory.
Sorry to drag you over here, but I really was tied up.
That's all right. I'm quite impressed to see that the head of Gregory Hood Importers has to work late occasionally, just like anyone else.
Oh, yes, Harry. You mustn't think that all my time is spent gallivanting around San Francisco. I'm quite a hard-working man on occasion. This afternoon, for instance, we received a particularly valuable shipment from China. Some exquisite jade pieces. I've been examining and cataloging them myself.
Is this piece on the desk part of the collection?
Yes. Do you want to buy it?
Well, what is it? Looks like just a chunk of jade with a hole through it.
It is, Harry, but it also happens to be an archer's thumb ring. Han period, 206 B.C.
How much?
In your case, Harry, I'll make a special price. Say, $15,000?
I'm afraid not. I'm a little short this month.
That's a beautiful specimen, Harry. I must show this to Richard Gump. He's got the finest collection in town. You know, it's funny this shipment arrived today.
Why?
Because the story I'm going to tell you tonight concerned a shipment of jade that I received just over a year ago. Only on that occasion, it was phony jade, and it gave me one of the worst headaches I've ever had. In fact, I darn nearly got myself murdered.
Murdered? How?
Well, it's a salutary tale that proves that being an amateur detective is a foolish and dangerous occupation. I suppose the story really began about 6 years ago in Lieutenant Silver's office in Homicide. My old friend was patiently trying to sweat the truth out of a certain gent by the name of Lem Carter, a murderer with what appeared to be a perfect alibi.
Come on, Carter. You know we've got you cold.
You ain't got nothing on me, copper.
Why don't you be smart? Plead guilty and take a self-defense rap. Otherwise, it's the gas chamber.
Not to that. I was in Carmel at the time of the murder scene. I'm sticking to it.
Hello, Stan.
Oh, hi, Greg.
Still at it, eh?
Yeah, this is one rat that won't squeal, Greg.
I've got a friend outside, Stan. I'd like you to meet her.
Look, Greg, I've no time for wenches now.
I don't know that I'd call her a wench, Stan. Inflation has set in somewhat. But I think she'll interest you and you, Carter.
I don't know no babes.
Funny, she knows you. Her name's Dodo Waring, and she's prepared to testify that she spent an hour with you in San Francisco on the night of the murder.
Okay, Gregory Hood. I know who you are, and I'll get you for this. I'll get you if it's the last thing I do.
As a matter of fact, it was the last thing he did, too. But that comes later.
How did you round up the girl, Gregory?
I have my contacts, Harry.
I'll bet. What happened to Carter?
Well, he had a good lawyer and got off with manslaughter. He went off to San Quentin, still swearing I'd pay with my life for putting the finger on him. I never gave him another thought until one night just over a year ago when my friend and attorney, Sanderson Taylor, and I were having drinks at the top of the Mark. I, by an odd coincidence, was waiting there to keep an appointment with an exceedingly beautiful young woman.
Gregory?
Yes, Sandy?
What's her name?
Whose name?
The girl you're waiting for.
I didn't say I was waiting for a girl.
You didn't have to. I know you well enough to recognize the symptoms. The red carnation in your buttonhole and the way you've been eyeing your watch tell their own story.
Hmm. What's her name? Sherry Drake.
Hmm. New conquest?
Mm-mm. This is to be something of a business meeting, Sandy.
And I'm sure you use the word business loosely.
Don't be cynical, Sandy. By the way, much as I love your company, will you beat a snappy retreat when the young lady arrives?
Huh? Afraid of competition, eh? You're aging, Gregory. Don't worry. Soon as I finish this last report, I'll be on my way. In any case, I have a wife and two children waiting for me in Berkeley. Hello, isn't that Lieutenant Silver standing in the entrance there?
Oh, sure it is. Stanley?
Here he comes.
Hello, Gregory.
Oh. Evening, Mr. Taylor.
Hi, Lieutenant.
Gregory, my boy, you're stuck with a guest tonight.
I know. She's due any moment.
I don't know about a she. You're stuck with me for the evening.
Look, Stan, you are a man of irresistible charm. Some of your anecdotes are fascinating, and you play a whiz of a game of chess. Another evening, we'll have a long session together, but
I'm afraid I'm going to have to insist, Greg.
What's up, Lieutenant?
Lem Carter got parole today.
Lem Carter?
Hey, that's the man that you put the finger on 5 years ago, Greg. Remember, he threatened you at the time.
Mm. I talked to guys who were in store with him, Greg. He's still swearing vengeance.
Well, no need to take that very seriously, is there?
I think there is. We put a tail on him the moment he got turned loose, but he gave us a slip. And I'm sticking with you, Greg, until he turns up. If he's toting a rod, there's a parole violation, and we've got him. But I'm keeping you safe until then.
I appreciate your concern, Stan, but I can look after myself.
It'll be safer to let the lieutenant stick with you, Gregory.
But I've got a date, and freeze a crowd.
Don't you worry, Greg. I can be discreet.
Oh, but Stan,
well, I'm going. I'll leave you guys to fight it out. What's in the package, Lieutenant?
A little present for you, Greg.
What is it? A wigwam for grinding smoke?
No, Greg, it's a lot more practical than that. And it's something we'd better discuss before your young lady shows up.
All right, but that's not all we're going to discuss. You duenna.
Are you sure we're not boring you, Lieutenant Silver?
Don't worry about me, young lady.
But we do worry about you, Stan. We've been sitting here at the top of the mark for nearly an hour, and all you've done is to drink four gigantic orangeades and look gloomy. Are you quite sure you wouldn't like to take a nice long ride on the cable car and meet us somewhere later?
Yes, Greg, I'm quite sure. Just carry on. Don't mind me.
Do you usually have a chaperone you date girls, Greg?
Not as a rule. It rather cramps my style.
And it's quite a style, too. Gregory?
Yes?
Where did you get my number?
Harry Bartell gave me the idea, and by an odd coincidence, he was talking about Sherry the other night, and I thought, what a nice name it would be for a girl. So I thumbed through the phone book until I found yours.
Oh, seriously, Gregory, how did you get it?
Oh, excuse me, back in the jiffy.
Don't hurry.
Yes, Dan, take your time.
Now, what do you suppose he's gone?
My dear young lady, let's not pry into his personal life. Let's accept the miracle of his disappearance gratefully and get down to business.
Business?
Yes, Sherry. I have a little unfinished business that I think you can help me with.
Oh, this is a new one. Go on, Gregory.
I am an importer, Sherry. 2 months ago, somebody switched a shipment of jade on me somewhere between Hong Kong and San Francisco.
You mean they substituted phony jade for the real stuff?
Yes, Sherry. I've been doing a little private snooping, and I have a hunch that a gent by the name of Hillary Pearson is at the back of it. I found out that you knew him, and that's why I called you.
Oh, yes, I do know him slightly. But I'm sure you're making a mistake, Gregory. Hillary's a straight shooter. I'd bet on that.
I wouldn't. I found out quite a bit about the gentleman in the past few days. He's just about as straight as a wriggly worm.
Good evening, Sherry.
Hello, Hillary.
Introduce me to your friend, won't you?
Why, yes. Hillary Pearson, this is Gregory Hood.
How do you do?
How do you do?
Hillary Pearson. I was just talking about you.
I thought you might be. That's why I came to your table. I think I know what you're doing, Mr. Hood. You're interested in that shipment of phony jade that's slipped by your agent, aren't you?
I'd be a mighty poor businessman if I weren't interested, my friend.
And you somewhere acquired the curious notion that Sherry knows something about it.
Have you ever thought of taking up mind reading?
Funny. Very, very funny, Mr. Hood. But I warn you, you're making a great mistake. I might even say you'd live to regret it if I thought there was the least likelihood that you'd live at all.
Hillary, what are you talking about?
Keep out of this, Sherry. You know what I'm talking about, don't you, Mr. Hood?
Oh, sure. I can recognize a threat just like the next man. Listen, Mr. Pearson, we're being chaperoned by Lieutenant Silvers of Homicide. He'll be back in a moment. Why not sit down and wait for him? He'd love to meet you.
I have no interest in meeting policemen. Don't forget what I've said, Mr. Hood.
He certainly had me fooled, Gregory. Why didn't you grab him? He threatened you.
Oh, he's not dangerous by himself. I'll have Silvers put a tail on him. Maybe he'll lead us to the whole gang. Well, Sherry, do you still think he's a straight shooter?
He's a rat. I'll never see him again.
Well, perhaps you can help me nab him, Sherry.
Oh, I'll tell you anything I can, Gregory, but there isn't much. I had a few dates with the guy. Jeepers, here comes the lieutenant again.
Welcome home, Stan. All is forgiven.
Anything interesting happen in my absence, Greg?
No, just another death threat.
You're kidding.
I'm not. People are queuing up to kill me. Oh, well, they start a line for anything these days.
Come on, Greg, give.
Well, a rather oleaginous gentleman by the name of Hillary Pearson just came up to our table. In a voice simply dripping with vitriol, he suggested Great Scott Sandy's come back. Not that I'm popular tonight. What's wrong, Sandy?
Gregory, I was worried about what the lieutenant told us about Lem Carter, so I drove by your apartment. I didn't get too good a look at the man across the street, but I'm certain it was Carter.
Good, we've got him now. Come on.
How about me?
I'm not letting go of you now, Sherry. Come along and watch the fun.
But, Gregory, you can't bring a girl.
Look, Sandy, whose murder is this, yours or mine? Come on. Come on, everybody.
Now, here's the apartment. If there's any shooting, Sherry, drop down in the back seat and keep down.
Don't worry about me, Gregory.
The guy's still there. See him in the doorway?
It's Carter, all right. I'll open the side window a little. I don't want to have to use this rod, but I'll keep it handy.
Carter spotted us. He's moving back in the doorway.
Well, let's see if I can talk a little sense into him.
Carter, don't be a dope and try to get down, Jerry. Okay, Carter, try this one on for size. We got him, Stan. Come on. He fell down the steps when you winged him.
Gregory, I think he's dead.
Sherry,
he should have stayed in the car.
I can't feel his pulse nor his heart either. He is dead.
He can't be. I wasn't aiming to kill.
There's one of your bullets in his leg.
He must have hit his head as he fell down the steps.
Yes, that's it. His neck's broken. He must have died instantly.
Sherry, darling, you seem remarkably handy with corpses.
I was a nurse's aide, Gregory. I can take it up.
Oh, and so saying, she fainted. Okay, Sandy, I've got her. Poor kid, the whole thing's been a little too much for her.
It's been a little bit too much for me, too.
She's a brave girl, Greg.
Yes, but this rather spoils the evening, doesn't it? Nothing left to do now but take the lady home and the corpse to the morgue. Oh, Stan.
Yes, Greg?
Thanks.
What for?
About Carter. I mean, well, he was gunning for me.
Oh, skip it, Greg.
Come on, let's get moving.
Didn't turn out the way I planned it.
Oh, for me. I should have been back in Berkeley hours ago.
Well, speaking for myself, I had a swell dinner.
Much obliged to you, Greg.
You're very welcome, Stan, and I'm obliged to you, Sandy, for driving me home. I'll see you in the morning.
Okay. Good night, Greg.
Good night.
Good night, Stan.
So long, Greg. But wait here until we see your lights go on. Might be someone else waiting for you.
Okay. But I think you overestimate my popularity.
So long.
Mm-hmm. I get myself into the dandy stand. Lem Carter gets the casket and my girlfriend's friends. Sandy's got his family. Who's there? Look, I know you're there. Come out of those shadows. Come on.
I'm okay, though.
You see who it was?
No. No, they must have escaped by the back stairs.
Oh,
thank the Lord you brought me that bulletproof vest, Sam.
Oh, so that was the present you gave Gregory at the mark tonight.
Yes. Lucky thing I didn't take it off after Carter was dead. But even with a steel vest, 3 bullets in the belly kind of knocked you out.
Hello. Here's a note under your doormat.
Hmm? What does it say, Mr. Taylor?
Let's see. I told you I'd get you if it was the last thing I did. Well, and it's signed Lem Carter.
But Lem's dead.
Oh, I get the pattern now. Somebody who wanted to kill me took advantage of Carter's release to frame it on him, not knowing he was dead already.
And so it didn't work.
Oh, yes, it did, Stan. I was murdered.
Huh? Well, what bright new trick is this, Gregory?
I was killed, or at least we'll let the would-be murderer think so. It'll lull him.
Good idea, Greg. I'll go ahead with an official investigation.
Fine, Stan. You do that, and I'll comb the underground in my own way.
Speaking as a very recent corpse, I think I may say I'm going to enjoy solving my own murder. You'll hear the rest of Gregory Hood's story in a second, which is all the time I need to tell you about Petri California Muscatel. Have you ever tried Petri Muscatel? I've noticed that it seems to be a particular favorite of the ladies. Perhaps that's because Petri Muscatel has such a beautiful golden color, bright as sunshine. But most likely it's because Petri Muscatel has a flavor that comes right from the heart of plump, luscious muscat grapes. Like Petri Port, Petri Muscatel is just perfect after dinner. As a matter of fact, why not buy a bottle of Petri Port and a bottle of Petri Muscatel? Don't buy one, buy two. But remember, always buy Petri.
Yes, Muscatel. The good stuff.
This is odd in that if you go back and listen to old Sherlock Holmes with Nigel Bruce. He as well had the Petri wine guy in his house. It was part of the vehicle that the Petri wine announcer was part of the program, likened to this.
There's a reason for that. The formats are nearly the same, and you have a lawyer and a guy that's an amateur detective instead of a doctor and a detective. Same sponsor, same organ. It was a summer replacement for Sherlock Holmes.
Mm.
That's why it seems so familiar. And the interesting story is, I guess Elliot Lewis was walking down the hall, and a guy came up and said, hey, would you be Gregory Hood for the radio? And he says, isn't that Gail Gordon's part? He says, well, yeah, but the sponsor isn't happy with Gail Gordon. I don't know why I'm enjoying this. But isn't happy with Gail Gordon, and they'd like you to do the part. He said, well, okay. And he gets there, and Gail Gordon is there. He says, Elliot, what are you doing here? He says, well, didn't they tell you? I've replaced you. Oh, really? Okay. He says, all right. Well, good luck with it. And off he went. And it was just they didn't even bother to tell Gail Gordon he'd lost his job. They just had somebody show up to do his part.
Gail did get three bucks before he left, though.
He did. But he had to give, you know, 30 cents back, so.
Yeah. Those so-and-sos, I think.
But
in
so
today's
that's the kind
dollars
of the,
is, I don't know.
$3?
What? I just did that. What does that do, Dan?
Yeah, but this was in 47, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway. Yeah, that's kind of the story behind here. And Dale, why don't we sneak in part two of Gail's interview before we get back to Gregory Hood solving his own murder?
Yeah, let's spend a little more time with Gail Gordon and Dave Shaden.
Well, I'm Chuck Shaden, and we're delighted to have with us on the line from Borrego Springs, California, Mr. Gail Gordon. Did you generally play more mature characters older than your own age?
Usually.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, yes. I played everything, juveniles and heavies in particular. And we all, of course, in radio had to do dialects or we couldn't work because in those days, if you were employed to do a part on a show, it was assumed that you would be able to double and do two parts so that the employer could have a show with 10 people in it and get 5 actors, and the 5 actors would do the 10 parts.
They didn't take double commission on those 10 parts,
No.
What kind of other dialects did you do then?
Well, I did the French, German, Irish, English, of course, having gone to school in England. I did that a great deal, played a great many Englishmen. And everybody in radio had to do at least 2 or 3 dialects. Mm-hmm. Italian, there was a dialect we called the international dialect, which is a little mishmash of everything, and we used that if it had to be some obscure country. You didn't know quite what it was, but it satisfied the listeners, so that was all that was necessary.
Now, you portrayed Flash Gordon in the 1930s, didn't you?
Yes, briefly, I was in New York and auditioned along with everybody else. In those days, you didn't do any part at all without auditioning with 10 or 20 or 30 people. And I got the part merely on the voice. The fact that my name was Gordon didn't mean a thing. I just was cast as the part. I did it for 8 or 10 episodes, I think. Then I came back to California. But I did. I was the original Flash Gordon on radio.
Now, I understand that when in radio, one's appearance didn't have anything to do with it at all. It was strictly the voice and the ability that you had to work with your voice.
That's right.
So you must have been rather versatile to have stayed employed all of those years. And I'm going to jump around just a little bit, you made a wonderful transition to television from radio, didn't you?
But then I'd been in the theater, so it's very easy. A lot of the people I worked with in radio who were just superb radio actors never did make it into television because they couldn't walk and talk at the same time. Mm-hmm. They were so used to standing in front of a microphone and fading in and out for a few steps that they didn't know how to use their bodies when it came to doing television. Well, I did because I'd been on stage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You worked on TV for a great many years with Lucille Ball.
Yes.
And everybody, I think, remembers the characterization of Mr. Mooney, the president of the bank, with Lucy for so many years.
Yes.
And then actually there was a slight switch in that series from the Lucy Show to Here's Lucy, and you took on a different name, really, but pretty much the same kind of character, right?
That's right.
You were...
Harrison Carter, Harrison Otis Carter, Alonzo, Mr. Mooney, and Uncle Harry in the third series. So that made me a part of the family because it was much easier for the writers to include someone who was part of the family, like going on a vacation.
Yeah.
They couldn't do that if I was just a banker.
I see.
Not an
adult. Oh, yeah, you had to go along with, right.
Yes.
Well, you started working with Lucille Ball in the radio days, actually.
Yes, before the I Love Lucy started, I did a radio show with her called My Favorite Husband.
So you played her husband's boss then, right?
Yes.
And that was also a bank president.
Right.
So they got you close to the money, don't they?
Well, yes, well, the idea in those days was that anyone who was a boss of a bank had to be a blowhard.
A character, actually, that you've portrayed to perfection over the years on so many shows. And I might also add that unlike yourself in real life.
Unlike me, who is... No. Well, actually, he's one of those. No. Well, maybe a little. We're going to play a whole lot more Gail Gordon as we move along.
But we got to Gregory Hood to wrap up there.
David, didn't you have a little anecdote you were going to tell us, or was that the second part of the interview you were talking about?
No, I was talking about how he got fired and didn't know he was fired.
Yeah.
Oh. Yep. Always get your $3 up front.
That.
Yeah.
Yep. $2.70 anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we put that into the Garculator, and it came up with it was like $56. No, I'm wrong. 1946, $3 is $1,341. That is not right.
No, that can't be right. That can't be right.
That can't be right.
No. Hang on.
You're not feeding your Garculator properly. You better feed it better.
I know. Come on, baby.
It runs on lithium batteries.
It's 1946.
Solar-powered ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's broken. I don't know what happened to it.
Yeah.
It wants a cookie or something. It keeps coming up with that weird number. 1,341. Oh, no, I read it wrong. It was 1,341% of inflation. The amount is $43.25. I was like, is something wrong with me? I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't
know. Well.
I could have paid the rent back in 47, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
46.
So, you could have paid the rent. That was $43.25. Now, I don't know what rent was back then, but I'm saying he's well on his way just with one radio show.
Just with one radio show, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that was a goofy thing he said in the interview. He said when radio first came out, they thought it was a fad, much like TV.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, this won't catch on. Yeah, right.
Well, and I'll bet some of them hoped that it was a fad, too, because they were accustomed to doing what they were doing.
So
it's interesting. I was reading an article that had Thomas Edison thinking that radio was just going to be a fad because he thought that his latest new phonograph would be the prime entertainment in the home, not radio.
So radio replaced the cylindrical and or LPs back in that's what it was replacing.
It was the chief home entertainment device in the house would have been a record player of one form or other. Edison did relent and go to the flat disc, but it was like three times thicker than the other discs that were out there.
Right, compared to what we had in our day. They were, were they, the 30, 38?
Oh, yeah, 10 times thicker than that, but yeah.
Yeah.
The original LPs were, an inch and a half, at least an inch thick, if not thicker.
Mm-hmm. And so the radio would replace what, dinner theater? I don't know what it could really replace.
For home entertainment, it replaced the record player.
Okay.
Yes.
And then when TV
came out, it replaced radio.
Yeah.
Well, let's flip the record side to.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, let's flip the record to side two of Murder of Gregory Hood from the casebook of
there we go.
Gregory Hood. We'll be back with more.
Well, Gregory, how did it feel to be a walking corpse?
Surprisingly pleasant, Harry. In fact, I'd say that a professional zombie probably has quite a gay life.
Did you find out who fired those three shots at you?
Oh, yes, but that comes a little later in the story. At the time, my only suspect was Hillary Pierce. After all, he'd threatened my life a short while before.
True, but... And this is almost heresy, Greg. You know who I suspect?
Who?
The girl, Sherry. And may I say how much I like that name?
You may.
In fact, I'd like to go a little further and say that...
Harry?
Okay, but it seemed to me that if this girl was mixed up with the Jade Gang...
But, Harry, don't you see? Because she was with us when Len Carter was killed, she was the only person who knew positively that she couldn't hope to frame a later killing on him.
I guess so. Well, Greg, what did you do next?
Well, as I say, Harry, Pearson was my only suspect, and I had a hunch it wasn't he. First, it wasn't his style, and second, the time element seemed to rule him out. But fortunately, I have some interesting contacts with the underworld, and I knew where to look for further suspects. While Sandy Taylor waited in my apartment, I spent a profitable half hour with some crepe hair and a bottle of spirit gum, giving myself what I thought to be quite a convincing beard.
As an official corpse, I guess you had to disguise yourself. And then?
Sandy and I drove over to a little hideaway on Market Street, a bar known as the Scarlet Dolphin. It has the most persistent jukebox. Oh, poor old Sandy. He was so patient with me that night.
I just called Mary.
Well, Sandy, did you explain your absence satisfactorily?
Yes, Mary's wonderfully understanding. Just the same, I can almost see that patient, knowing smile of hers when I tell her I'm going to a bar with you, strictly on business.
Mary is a very remarkable girl.
Incidentally, now that we're here, just what are we doing in the Scarlet Dolphin?
Waiting to talk to Ole O'Leary.
Ole O'Leary? An expert on yodeling, no doubt.
Can he help it if he had an Irish father and a Swedish mother?
What's his specialty?
He's the Winchell of the underworld. Oh, Stanley, this crepe hair is driving me crazy.
If you must go around being a corpse, Gregory, at least you deserve to be uncomfortable.
Here comes Ole now.
What'll it be, Mac?
We don't want to drink, Orly, just information.
Gregory, what are you doing with that chin mop?
Being a corpse. Orly, can you use a pin?
Are you kidding? Come to daddy. Thanks, Greg. What do you want to know?
Did you know Lem Carter was out of hock?
Sure. Got out this morning.
You know his contact?
Yeah. Just one, though, Greg. A dame.
Name and address, Orly.
Ruby Hart. Devonshire Apartments on Kirk.
Thanks, Orly. So long.
Okay. Thanks for the pin. Good luck, Greg.
When Ruby comes through the door, Sandy, remember that you're playing this scene.
Oh, don't worry, Gregory. I'm not simple-minded. A child of three can...
Yeah?
Miss Ruby Hart?
Yeah.
May we come in?
Who are you?
I'm Mr. Gregory Hood's lawyer, and this is my secretary, Mr. Bunker.
Gregory Hood's lawyer, huh?
Yes.
Okay. Come in. Well, what's on your mind?
You may have heard that Lem Carter was killed this evening.
No, I didn't. My mascara's all run because I was reading a sad book. Now listen, brother. If you come here to gloat, I'm liable to crown you.
Oh, but I haven't. Mr. Hood feels that he is in part liable for Lem Carter's death.
And he ain't kidding, brother.
He wishes to make some financial contribution. He feels that if Mr. Carter had any close associates or dependents...
Lem had me. That's all. And that's enough. Or it could have been.
You've known him for some time?
I've known him no time. Never heard of him before he went to San Quentin, but I had a brother. He was a buddy of Lem's there. Lem wrote my letters to Joe, and so he started writing to me, and I wrote back to him, see? That made me come alive all over. That letter writing. So he came out and saw me. Just once. Just today. It was just like his letter. Only with flesh and blood in him. And now he's dead. And I got lawyers crawling around me, asking about financial dependence and stuff. It was just us, see? Them didn't see nobody else before they got him. All our lives, there was going to be nobody but us. And now we're to get this Sand Hill out of here. I want to go on reading that sad book.
Please believe me, Miss Hart, when I say that Mr. Hood...
Scram, both of you. Go on, brother, get moving.
I'm sorry if you think...
Yeah, break your heart, don't it? Good night. Lem's sorry that he missed you.
Sorry, that was your job, Sandy.
Yeah, me too. Poor girl, I'm sorry for her.
So am I, Sandy. I feel like a rather elderly, near-white slug. And about those financial contributions, as Ruby would say, I ain't kidding, brother. Anybody that can find good in Lem Carter deserves all I can do. But this was a dead end, no clues there.
What's the next move, Gregory?
The Jade Trail and a girl named Cherry. It's only 11:30, not too late to call.
Why not remove the beard?
No, Sandy, no. She's a brave girl. Let's see how she faces up to Midnight Shadow. Incidentally, I'll play the next scene alone, if you don't mind.
I don't mind. I'll wait for you in your apartment. Too late to drive back to Berkeley tonight anyway.
If your wife only knew a smart attorney, she could cite me as good grounds for divorce. Okay, Sandy, wait for me back at the apartment. I have the feeling that the next scene won't take very long.
Gregory, I'm so glad you came back to see me tonight. Just the same when you walked in wearing that ridiculous beard,
down near fainted again, Sherry?
I should have. Might have been smart, too. I understand that men like a ladylike swoon.
Not to the extent of complete unconsciousness, Sherry. How are you feeling now?
Fine, Gregory.
Nice place you have here, Sherry.
It's a modest little shack, but I like it. Gregory.
Yes?
You look worried.
Quite frankly, I am.
What's wrong?
After I left you tonight, somebody tried to ventilate me with bullets.
Gregory, no.
Oh, yes, they did. Fortunately, I was wearing a tin vest. Otherwise, I'd be in the morgue now.
Where did it happen?
I was entering my apartment.
Could you see who it was?
No, it was too dark. Sherry.
Yes, Greg.
I've got a list of questions a yard long for you, but before I ask them, I want to do a little checking. Do you mind if I use your phone?
Of course not. Go ahead.
You see, officially, I'm supposed to be a corpse.
Well, I wish you'd stop being one. I don't like bearded men.
Well, I may be able to take it off as soon as I've made this call.
Police headquarters.
Lieutenant Silver's in homicide, please.
Just a minute.
All right. Did Hillary Pearson call you this evening, Sherry?
Hillary? No one's called.
Silver speaking.
Excuse me. This is Gregory.
Hi, Greg. Did you dig up any leads?
No, Stan. How about you?
Nothing yet. Oh, yes, one thing you might want to know about that note we found on your doorstep.
The one from Carter, yes?
We've had no chance to authenticate the handwriting yet, but... Lousy with Carter's fingerprints.
What's that?
I say the note was lousy with Carter's fingerprints. Does that suggest anything to you?
Yes. Yes, it does. It gives me the answer. Thanks, Sam.
Learn anything, Gregory?
Yes, I did, Sherry. Maybe everything.
Well, before you tell me about it, come over here on the sofa. I want to show you my pet view. Moonlight on the bay. We don't need a light, do we? Oh, isn't it beautiful, Gregory?
So are you, Sherry.
Well, thank you, sir.
You're very beautiful. And you wore gloves this evening, didn't you?
Oh, don't talk so much. Gregory.
Yes?
Maybe I could learn to like beer.
Why, you little devil!
You got this coming in your lap!
A knife! There's only one answer to that, darling!
That wasn't a very gentlemanly action, Gregory.
I know, Sandy, but my old father used to say, never strike a woman until she pulls a knife on you.
Shouldn't that be unless?
My old father always said until. Maybe that's why I'm still a bachelor.
Did you have much of a job getting her over to the station?
No, she was out cold until Silvers got there. Then she screamed bloody murder and fought like a wildcat.
Quite a female. Did she spill anything?
Plenty. Hillary Pearson was at the back of it. Silvers is picking him up tonight, and in the morning I'll prefer charges. And with Sherry on the spot, I don't think it's going to be hard to track down our Jane.
She was a smart girl to realize you'd guessed her secret the moment you'd talked to Silver.
Well, she must have heard him talking about the fingerprints, but it was smart figuring on her part.
And on yours too, Gregory.
You see, the fingerprints proved the note was genuinely from Carter.
He planned to leave it by your body after he'd shot you, I suppose.
Instead of which, he was shot first. Therefore, the note was stolen from his body. Only Sherry could have done that while she was performing her nurse's aid act with the corpse. The fact that she was wearing gloves kept her fingerprints off the note.
She was a smart one.
Darn smart, because she appeared to be the one person who couldn't have framed the dead Carter. She thought the frame-up attempt would clear her completely, the double switcheroo. Very neat, and I nearly fell for it.
It was quick thinking on your part to piece it all together as soon as you had the phone message.
I almost wish I hadn't pieced it together quite so fast, Sandy.
Hmm? Why, Gregory?
Oh, the man asks why. Sherry was a very beautiful girl, Sandy. And the moonlight was quite potent. Sometime I must tell you what my old father used to say about that.
Well, Greg, as usual, that story was a knockout. You're the most popular corpse I've met in ages.
Yes, Harry, it seems that everybody's just dying to kill me.
Oh, and that girl, Sherry.
You know, Harry, there's one woman who almost got me for life.
You're not kidding.
Tell me, Harry, if she'd succeeded, would you miss me?
Greg, how can you talk like that?
Would you really miss our little Monday evening get-together?
Why, sure. I feel a little silly talking about Pepsi wine to myself.
Oh, I should have known it. One-track mind Bartell. But I guess you're right. Good detectives are a dime a dozen, but good wine.
Ah. And when you say good wine, naturally you mean Petri wine. Why, the Petri family has been making wine for generations. The art of turning luscious, sun-ripened grapes into delicious, fragrant wine is their heritage. A heritage handed on down within the Petri family from father to son, from father to son. No wonder Petri wine is so good. No wonder the Petri business has grown and grown so that today the Petri family are America's largest independent winemakers. Yes, the making of Petri wine is a family affair, and the Petri family has every intention of keeping it that way, because by so doing, they can be sure that every bottle of wine that bears the name Petri is and always will be good wine. Well, Gregory, what page of your notebook are you turning to next week?
Next week, Harry, I'm going to tell you an odd story that took place in an extremely dense fog in the Berkeley Hills. It concerns a disappearing wife, a haunted house, and a hot clarinet player. I'll see you next Monday, Harry.
The Casebook of Gregory Hood is written by Dennis Green and Anthony Boucher. Original music is composed and played by Dean Fossler. Gail Gordon plays the part of Gregory Hood, and Sanderson Taylor is played by Art Gilmore. The Petri Wine Company of San Francisco, California, invites you to tune in again next week, same time, same station. The Casebook of Gregory Hood comes to you from our Hollywood studio. This is Harry Bartell saying goodnight for the Petri family.
Gar, you got to love that organ, huh? From
Casebook
of Gregory Hood. And we're learning all about Gail Gordon. Let's learn something else. Erie House Radio proudly presents Gar's Moral of the Story.
Just because they're pretty doesn't mean they're not guilty.
There you go. Words to live by with Garth.
Does this look like a murderer to you?
Yes.
As they asked Sharon Stone. But I digress as we celebrate.
Or Alec Baldwin. Oh, never mind. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
He's always shooting off about something. So let's listen to... How about a little more of that Gail Gordon interview? There's some really cool stuff coming out on this. And I'd like to hear a little more.
I have a clip from a My Favorite Husband broadcast from 1949. And that was Richard Denning and Lucille Ball as George and Liz Cooper. And you were Rudolph Atterbury, the president of the bank where George Cooper worked.
Yes.
And your wife on that show
was Bee Benaderet.
Bee Benaderet. That was Iris.
Yes.
Iris. In this clip that we have, you'll also hear from one of the great supporting actors on radio, Mr. Frank Nelson.
Yes.
He was a waiter in this little scene. This is at a restaurant, and Lucy wants her husband, George, in this scene. Liz wants George to ask you, Mr. Atterbury, for a raise. Now, if you hang on for just a few minutes, we're going to listen together to this clip from My Favorite Husband.
Right.
Maybe someday we can afford those extra luxuries, but right now we've got to cut corners.
Well, it's not my spending that's the trouble. It's your salary. I think
Hold
it's the least...
I know just what you're going to say. George, I think you should ask for a raise.
I certainly do. What's the matter with Mr. Atterbury, anyway? You've been with the bank 10 years, and you haven't got a thing to show for it.
I have, too. Don't forget my 10-year pin.
Well, pretty soon you'll have to use it to hold your 10 years' trousers together. You're afraid to ask him for a raise.
I am not.
You are, too. Georgie is a sissy. Georgie is a sissy.
All right. Now, look, if it'll make you feel any better, I gave Mr. Atterbury a very strong hint yesterday.
Really? Did you really, George?
I certainly did. We were having lunch, and Mr. Atterbury said, George, it's getting hard for a man to make both ends meet these days.
Oh, what an opening. And what did you say?
I said, it sure is.
That's all?
Yes.
He didn't get upset by your strong language, did he?
Well, he...
George, you've got to speak plainer. Come right out and ask him for a raise.
Well, things like that just aren't done down at the bank.
Then do it away from the bank. Ask him tonight at dinner. We're eating out with the Atterburys, you know.
I won't talk business at dinner.
All right, if you won't, I will.
Oh, no, you don't.
Don't worry, George. I'll bring it up subtly.
Yeah, I know you're subtly. Good evening, Mr. Atterbury. Sorry we're late, and why don't you give George a raise?
All right, George. I won't say anything if you'll promise me one thing.
What?
For heaven's sake, don't pay the check. No wonder he thinks you don't need more money. You always pick up the check when the four of us go out to dinner.
I do not.
You do, too. Although I'll admit it isn't your fault. Mr. Atterbury can out-fumble anyone.
Oh, now, that isn't fair. He pays as often as I do.
Oh, sure. You pick up the check for dinner and dancing at the Biltmore, and then when we're at the ball game having peanuts, he says, it's my turn, boys.
You're exaggerating.
Use your eyes, George. Every time the check comes, he's looking down, studying his fingers. You'd think he just discovered a uranium under his nails.
Now that you mention it, he has done that a couple of times.
Sure. You don't have a chance between his fingernails and that trick fork of his.
trick fork.
You've seen it. The minute the waiter brings the bill, Mr. Atterbury's fork jumps under the table, and he drops out of sight to look for it.
Hey, that happened just the other night, didn't it?
You know it did. The zipper got stuck in your wallet, and Mr. Atterbury had to stay under the table 45 minutes.
Golly, Liz, I think you hit on something there. Why, that big tightwad.
Then you'll make him pay the bill tonight?
You're darn right I will. And as long as we're sticking Atterbury with it, let's stick him good.
Oh, you mean order everything expensive?
Everything we order is going to be either a la carte, imported, or out of season.
Oh, good. I think I'll have caviar smothered in caviar.
I could just see Atterbury's face when he gets the bill.
Yeah, make the waiter crawl under the table and hand it to him.
Yeah.
And remember, George, now don't weaken him.
I won't, even if we have to sit and drink water until he gets the idea.
Yeah, and if I know him, when we walk out of there, we'll squish.
Wonder what's keeping Liz and George. What time is it, Irish girl?
Oh, it's just 7, Rudolph. We're early.
Oh. You know, George has been acting funny lately. I think he'd like to ask me for a raise, but he hasn't got the nerve.
Well, I'm surprised he hasn't asked you. You'd think the bank was making $1 million the way you throw your money away.
Me? Throw money away? What are you talking about, Lotus Bud?
Well, for one thing, every time we go to dinner with Liz and George, you pick up the check.
Oh, I wouldn't say every time.
I would. Although I'll admit it isn't your fault. George Cooper can outfumble anyone.
Well, now that isn't fair, Iris. He pays as often as I do.
Sure. You buy box seats to the symphony, and he pays the tax on free passes to the circus.
Well, that doesn't happen all the time.
To say nothing of his two wallets. One, he has the zipper welded together. And the other one is made out of a magic carpet. As soon as the check appears, it shifts to another suit at home.
Well, now that you mention it, that does happen pretty often. And if those don't work, he goes to make a phone call. Well, tonight I think I'll just teach that young scamp a lesson.
Are you going to outweigh him?
You bet I am. George pays the bill for this meal. And as long as we're going to stick him, let's stick him good.
You mean order everything expensive?
Yeah.
Ooh, what fun!
Here they come. Remember, the sky's the limit.
Yoo-hoo, George boy, Liz girl, here we are.
Hi, Mr. Atterbury.
Hello, Liz girl, George boy.
Hi, everybody.
Well, sit down, sit down.
Oh, my, I'm starved. I feel like eating something extra special tonight.
Yes, me too.
Get the waiter, Rudolph. Let's not waste any time.
Yeah. Waiter?
Yes, sir?
We'd like to order, please.
Very well.
Why don't we start off with some champagne?
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, okay by me.
That's a fine idea. Then you want a bottle of champagne?
Yes, bring a bottle for each of us.
Now, which would you like, domestic or imported?
Imported!
Are you sure you haven't had enough to drink already?
No, we're sober as judges. What else would you have, Liz?
I think I'll have a porterhouse steak.
Yeah, one porterhouse steak.
As an appetizer.
As an appetizer?
Mm-hmm. I'd like a double lobster thermidor.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, that sounds good. I think I'll have that, too.
Instead of the steak?
No, just pour it over the steak.
I'll have beef stroganoff.
I'd like a filet mignon with wild rice and an anchovy salad.
Yes, sir.
Oh, and some artichokes and drawn butter.
And some water chestnuts and bamboo shoots.
And bring a side order of pheasant under glass. Ooh, what a bunch of spenders.
Oh, and for dessert, crepe Suzette and cherry's jubilee and a baked Alaska. Waiter. Waiter, what's the matter? What are you dreaming about?
Oh, if I was only working on commission, I could retire. Hey, now, let's see. Who ordered the pit shampoo?
What?
Oh, that's French champagne. I'm so excited, I can't read my own writing.
Hey, that was a nice little episode there from My Favorite Husband. Boy, I wonder if that inspired the Lucy Show or not.
You know what? What B. Benaderet and we'll hear it tomorrow. But B. Benaderet and Gail Gordon kind of took these two characters, changed the name, but those are the two that ended up being in Granby's Green Acres. There, we'll hear that tomorrow night.
Yep.
But yeah.
And was Granby's Green Acres possibly an inspiration for the television series with Eddie Arnold and his wife? Wasn't Eve Arden?
Ava Gabor. Yeah. Yes.
Ava Gabor. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Paul Henning had something to do with that original radio series, and he was the one that had, of course, produced Beverly Hillbillies and Petticoat Junction. And according to him, they wanted another show. So without even a pilot, they bought his idea for Green Acres, and he based it on Granby's Green Acres from radio.
Ah, nice. Who knew?
Who knew? There's actually a haunted episode of Green Acres with Eddie Albert. And yes. There's a ghost figure that shows up, and every time someone mentions her name, something falls off of a shelf or something like that and breaks. And she's only seen in a mirror.
Sounds like a shelf that I built. Everything would fall off.
Is that like Mary Worth? I believe in Mary Worth.
Well, no, they never provoke her through the mirror. It's not like Candyman or whatever that was. Or Mary Murder or whatever. It was, let's see. Here we go. It was Green Acres, and it's The Ballad of Molly Turgis, 1966. And Molly Turgis, anytime that name was said, something would break in the barn. Mr. Haney's truck started and drove itself to another town. All kinds of stuff. Yeah.
I think I've seen that. Did you show that?
I'm going to. It's been garified.
Okay. I think I've mentioned Mr. Haney's truck driving off. I do remember that. Hey, there's one other thing. We're about to go into another comedy that Gail Gordon was a good part of, Armis Brooks. But before we do that, one of the iconic roles he got to play was on Fibber McGee and Molly. And he started off just as – it was supposed to be just a one-off as Molly McGee's former beau. And he came back to visit Molly Driscoll, is her maiden name. And it went over so well, they came up with another character for him. And one of the characters was Mayor Latrivia. And what happened is Molly and Fibber would tag team up against him to get him so flustered, the Mayor Latrivia would never know. I'd love to play a short clip from Fibber McGee and Molly in which they got a hold of him. Is that okay?
Yeah, Dave, fire away. Of course.
Here we are.
Got a date of 1943, maybe?
I don't know. Play, darn you.
Play.
The Johnson Wax Program. The Johnson Wax Program with Fibber McGee and Molly. Johnson's Wax Products for Home and Industry present Fibber McGee and Molly with Bill Thompson, Gail Gordon, Arthur Q. Bryant, and me, Harlow Wilcox. The script is by Don Quinn and Phil Leslie. Music by the King's Men and Billy Mills Orchestra.
Oh, McGee, it's Mayor Latrivia. Hello, Mr. Mayor.
Hello, Molly. McGee.
Hi, Latrivia. Sit down briefly. According to my schedule, I can give you 1 minute and 10 seconds, boy.
I'll settle for the 10 seconds, McGee. I've had it. Good day.
Oh, no, Mr. Don't go. Just sit right here and visit with me a while. Himself here is on a tighter schedule than the Berlin airlift, but I'm loafing.
I'm putting the housework on a business basis, Latrivia. Everything on schedule. Efficiency, boy. You ought to try that at the City Hall sometime.
I'm trying to get several efficiency measures through the City Council now, McGee.
Oh?
In fact, I had lunch at the hotel with President Bates of the Council yesterday to talk about it.
Bates?
Oh.
Isn't he the man who fought you so hard the last time you ran for mayor, Mr. Mayor? And you had lunch with him?
Yes. Yes, if it will help to improve our government, Mrs. McGee, I can work with him. Politics, you know, make strange bedfellows.
How was that again, Latrice?
Oh, I merely remarked that politics make strange bedfellows. You see...
Did you have to stay overnight, Mr. Mayor?
Overnight? Where?
At the hotel where you had lunch. You said there was a strange fellow in your bed, so naturally...
No, McGee, I didn't mean that.
McGee found a horse in his bed one time. At a Legion convention, Mr. Mayor. But a bed full of strange politicians is worse.
Yeah.
You can shoot a horse, but a politician...
Please, just a minute. When I said politics make strange bedfellows...
You
referring...
said a mouthful, boy. You really did. I went to a political rally in Chicago one time and had to share a room with two fat senators and a ward healer named Beeler. Was there a healer named Beeler in your room, Latrivia, because of...
No, there wasn't. I didn't have any room. I didn't say I had a room. There wasn't any room at all, do you understand?
I'll say we understand, boy. The way them hotels ram six or eight politicians into a room that was built for three brooms in a bucket, there ain't room in the room for anybody. How could you sleep that way, Latrivia, with all...
I didn't creep that way.
Huh?
I leaped that day. Hey! I mean, look!
Now. Mr. Mayor, don't shout. Days. Noise won't settle this.
Oh, sir, be calm, boy. We're your friends, Latrivia.
Heaven help me.
Now, you said you went to a luncheon, Mr. Mayor.
Yes.
And then you said politics make strange bedfellows.
Yes, but I was...
Tell me one thing. Was there a ward healer named Beeler there? Because of all the strange bedfellows, he snored louder than...
There wasn't any strange bedfellow. A strange bedfellow. A lead fellow. Look! When I said politics make strange strange bedfellows, I didn't say anything about a strange room full of politicians. Full of politicians. Politicians. Full of mission. You're the one that said it.
McGee.
Yes, boy?
I'd like to ask a favor. The police department pistol team is shooting target practice tomorrow morning. Would you help them out?
Oh, he'd love to, Mr. Mayor.
I'll be there, boy. Hey, what do they shoot at, Latrivia?
You'll find out.
You'll find out.
Oh, yes.
Very nice, as we celebrate Gail Gordon's 100 millionth birthday. 116.
Yes. Dave, I caught something up in the chat in the room. Is that the correct thing, maybe? Too much energy?
I'd have to look that up. I don't know that... I don't know if I have the...
Because they were talking about energy when it first started.
Okay. Oh, is that what it said? Too much energy? Okay. Then that probably is correct.
That's what I found. Maybe I am. Maybe no, I got lucky.
Good man.
Good detective work, Gregory.
Yeah. My garculator was fired up, all ready to go.
There you go.
So, yeah, he was known as the master of the slow burn, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, wasn't he?
Yeah. He had some great
characters. Someone called him that.
He had some great characters to torture him over the years, not just Lucy, but I came to really understand him more as an actor and a character actor at that when I started doing this show with you, Dave, and Gar. And got to experience Mr. Conklin on our Miss
Brooks.
Yes. Our Miss Brooks. Yes. Now, that's Eve Arden, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, okay. Yeah, and, she is just...
And they both carried it. As a matter of fact, most of the cast carried it through to television as well. Everyone but Mr. Boyden, Jeff Chandler, because he'd found success in the movies. And so they wouldn't let him out of his contract to go do television.
I'm going to have to dig through them, their internets, because I have yet to have seen any of the television adaptations, but have been lucky enough to hear a handful of the Artemis Brooks radio version. And we got tonight an episode,
Weird Calling.
I just don't know how to describe it, Dave.
the Weird Calling, Impressing the School Board. How's that?
Impressing the School Board. This episode will forever be known going forward. And the original broadcast...
Not trying to confuse me, though, right?
No, because your guess for a broadcast date is just as good as mine.
Here we go. January 1st, 1956.
Or so.
Now it's Artemis Brooks starring Eve Arden.
The life of an average school teacher tends to run along a fairly smooth and even path. But if that teacher's name is Constance Brooks and she teaches English at Madison High School, that path is apt to be not quite so smooth and even.
Somehow, while most girls go through life attracting boys, I go through it attracting accidents. Wednesday, as I was leaving Clay City High after a visit with a friend, I hit the jackpot of all accidents. I was walking toward the elevator, my mind off in space, when a few seconds later, so was I. I had stepped into an open elevator shaft. The next thing I knew, I was hanging by my fingertips. Jason Brill, Clay's principal, had rushed up and pulled me to safety. The newspaper photographers had taken our pictures, and we were so busy, I didn't have a chance to faint until I got home. The next morning, as my landlady and I sat down to breakfast, I slipped the newspaper casually under Mrs. Davis's eyes and waited for her reaction. Finally, it came. In tones quivering with excitement, she said,
Connie, what's a two-letter word meaning sun god?
Mrs. Davis, look.
No, dear. Look has four letters. Maybe I should try it vertical. Now, let's see. What's a three-letter word for feline domestic animal?
Meow.
Oh, no. Quiet, Minerva, and finish your milk. Now, three-letter word for feline domestic animal.
Meow. It's no use, Minerva. Mrs. Davis, if you'll forget that crossword puzzle for a moment and look at the front page, you might see a story about a person you know that will interest you.
Oh, all right, dear.
Well?
Oh, my goodness. Why, Connie, this is your picture. A picture of you and Jason Brill. But what are you two doing on the front page?
If you'll read the story, you'll see what we're doing there.
A story? Oh, that's right. There is a story. Jason Brill, principal of Clay City High School, played the hero yesterday as he hoisted Constance Brooks, Madison High English teacher, out of an open elevator shaft. Miss Brooks had been dangling by her fingertips three stories up with the elevator a floor above her when she was finally rescued. Oh, Connie, how awful. But, dear, I don't quite understand.
Don't quite understand what, Mrs. Davis?
Wouldn't it have been simpler to wait for the elevator like everybody else?
Not with my claustrophobia. Mrs. Davis, the whole thing was an accident. A horrible, nightmarish accident.
Oh, of course, dear. Were you hurt?
No, I'm all right today. Now, please don't worry about me, Mrs. Davis. I have as many lives as...
Meow!
No coaching, Minerva. Don't you want to read the rest of the story?
I'm reading it now. Mr. Brill, who is currently one of the principals being considered for promotion to assistant superintendent of schools, was extremely modest about his daring rescue. When asked to comment, he said, "This is nothing that any other aggressive, vigorous, alert, level-headed, courageous man wouldn't have done under similar circumstances."
If it his whole comment, he would have been elected to Congress. As it is, I doubt if he'll make assistant superintendent. At least not while Mr. Conklin is also trying for the job.
Oh, is Osgood still after that position?
Like Dick Tracy is after Rughead. Why, today our boy unveils his Project X in front of Mr. Stone.
Project X? Goodness, it sounds important. What is it, dear?
If I know Mr. Conklin, it's probably a scientific method of making six teachers do the work of one principal. Frankly, Mrs. Davis, I'm dying to find out about Project X myself. Mr. Conklin's promised me that this morning he's letting the cat out of the bag.
Meow!
Back in the bag, Minerva.
In any case, Connie, it might be a good idea to drop in and see your principal before your first class. He'll be so relieved to see you unscratched. He'll fuss over you like a cat over her baby kitten.
Meow! Yes, Minerva, they're playing our song. Mr. Conklin, in perfect health, none the worse for wear, not a scratch on me, and ready to start the day's work with a brave smile. So don't you worry one bit.
Sit down, you traitor.
Mr. Conklin, didn't you read the story about me in the morning paper?
7 times. Miss Brooks, you knew I was in a life and death struggle with Jason Brill for assistant superintendent. You knew that making him a hero would practically ruin my chances. For lo, these many years, you have been enjoying all of your accidents right here at Madison. And now, when I need you most, why did you have to take your business elsewhere?
It was rather thoughtless of me, sir.
And I was so confident that when I unveiled my Project X before Mr. Stone at 3 this afternoon, it would dwarf all of Brill's recent projects. But now, with his heroes.
Is this your Project X, sir? This desk microphone and the instrument panel with push buttons?
Yes. It's an amplifying system. Sitting right here in my office, I can press buttons and hear what's going on in any classroom or hallway. I can check on my teachers and students at any time. Board of Education was delighted when I suggested they try out the system at Madison.
Would you show me how it works, sir?
Well, I had promised my daughter Harriet she would be the first to hear it this morning, but I don't know what's happened to her.
Oh, I'm certain she wouldn't mind if I heard it first.
No, I suppose not. Well, all right, I'll flick it on. We'll warm up with room 100, although it may be unoccupied at this early hour.
Oh, come on, Harriet. Just one little kiss.
No, Walter. Daddy wouldn't like it.
Who wants to kiss him?
Harriet, one teensy-weensy little kiss.
Denton, unpuck her this instant.
What? Harriet, you know you're getting to sound more like your old man every day.
Well, that wasn't me, Walter.
Well, don't tell me it's my conscience talking.
Denton, this is your principal talking.
And no conscience ever shouted like that.
Holy cow, now Miss Brooks' voice is coming out of the woodwork. Come on, Harriet, let's get out of here.
Well, that's my Project X, Miss Brooks. And if you hadn't made a hero out of Jason Brill, it would have been enough to sway Mr. Stone in favor of my promotion. I tell you frankly, if Mr. Stone selects Jason Brill for that job, I'm going to be in a very ugly mood indeed.
Yes, sir.
I will hark back constantly to the incident that caused my defeat, knowing always at whose doorstep to lay the blame. You can imagine what may occur.
Yes, sir. For the next 6 months, you're liable to trample all over my welcome mat. Well, since I had made a hero out of our principal's arch rival, Jason Brill, Mr. Conklin felt that I had cost him his promotion to assistant superintendent. Just before lunch, Mrs. Davis phoned to find out how I was feeling, and I gave her a rundown of the situation.
Connie, I'm amazed at Osgood. Do you mean he wasn't a bit happy to see you up and around?
He acted more like he wished I were down than under. He feels I've cost him his promotion.
Well, he's just upset, dear. Why, with a wonderful project like that amplifying system, he should be able to walk into that new job.
Over a road of broken eardrums. That system is driving us all crazy, Mrs. Davis. He listens in on us in the classrooms, in the hallways, in the recreation room. And a few minutes ago, I had the shock of my life in the female faculty room.
My goodness. Well, Osgood is just sulking, Connie. Still, it would have been better for you if he had been the hero.
Well, it's too late to worry about that now, since... Mrs. Davis, what did you just say?
Well, I said...
Oh, goodness, Tommy, I'm afraid I wasn't paying attention. What did I say?
Yes. Why not?
No, I'm certain I didn't say yes. Why not?
Mrs. Davis, you're a lifesaver. Well, goodbye now. I've got to meet Mr. Boynton in the lunchroom and break the good news to him.
Good news? What good news, Connie?
That at 3 p.m. today, he's going to be rescued by Mr. Conklin from a terrible accident.
Say, that pie was better than they usually make down here.
Yes, it was.
Oh, now, you said you had a big favor to ask me. What is it?
Yes, I did want to ask a favor, Mr. Boynton, but perhaps I'd better not ask it here. You know who might be listening in on us right now.
Who? Which who? Oh.
Yes, that who. I wish I could whisper it to you, though. Bring your ear over closer. Now, listen.
That tickled. You know, you sent a chill right down my spine.
Care to do me now? I mean, let's just talk in low tones.
Oh, Miss Brooks, believe me, you're worrying needlessly. I'm sure Mr. Conklin has something better to do than listen in on lunchroom conversations. But if you're worried, why don't you just write down what you have to say on a napkin? What do you think of that idea?
I think it's the sneakiest thing I've heard today.
Mr. Conklin. Gosh, you were right, Miss Brooks.
Don't get panicky, friend. Just follow me across to the unoccupied zone of Madison High. We'll be perfectly safe from him here in the boiler room, Mr. Boynton. There isn't a wire in the place, see?
Still, he's here, Miss Brooks. I can feel it in my bones. This room is wired, too. I know he's here.
Mr. Boynton, look. I'll prove to you once and for all that Mr. Conklin has no wires down here. Here's a paper bag on the floor. I'll blow it up and explode it near the ceiling. Watch. Get up off your knees.
I can't hear you. What happened to my eardrum? Where is everybody?
Mr. Conklin?
I can't hear you. Say something, somebody. Please.
Mr. Conklin, can you hear me, sir?
Talk, somebody. I can't hear you. Say something. Stop bothering.
Go jump in the lake, fish face.
For yourself, meathead. Hear what I called him, Miss Brooks?
If it's a question of your getting the Medal of Honor, I'll be your witness.
Well, now that Mr. Conklin can't hear us, what was that big favor you wanted?
Mr. Stone is coming over at 3 this afternoon to hear the amplifying system in action. And when he presses the button to hear what's going on in your laboratory, I was wondering if you could be in the midst of a fake accident yelling for help.
Oh, I see. You mean if I have this fake accident and Mr. Conklin saves me, Mr. Stone may pick him for that promotion and we'll be rid of him and his amplifying system.
You ain't just burning your Bunsen, Boynton. That's right, I mean. Now, just in case Mr. Conklin has regained his hearing, let's go outside and talk over the details.
Well, all right, Miss Brooks. Follow me. This back door leads to the athletic field.
Here we go with part one of our Miss Brooks mystery version.
No, yeah, well, he did lose his hearing, didn't he? Yes, he did.
Yes. Dave, I have a question. Maybe you know the answer. Maybe you don't. Maybe Dale knows the answer. Maybe he doesn't.
Yeah,
I don't know. Okay, so when we're listening to all these amazing epic radio plays from the past, there is sometimes excessive laughter. Now, we as a listener hear what they're saying, and we're not laughing any harder than anything else. Is there something going on some type of a visual cue happening in studio that's busting these the studio audience up even more.
Usually not. They had, you know, they had a warm up like they had, you know, for today's shows and today's sitcoms. Somebody would come out and warm up the audience. A lot of times from Phil Harris and Al's Face Show, Phil would go out and warm up the audience before, you know, before the show. And that was a live studio audience. There was no canned laughter. A lot of the canned laughter, especially in television and sitcoms that later on would come from the Red Skelton Show, because Red did a lot of pantomime things and the audience would react and laugh. But I think it was basically they were up on stage acting this out. The situations were funny enough, but if that's all you were and you were in a sense a theater watching these people do this, and, you know, yeah, they're going to get a little excited. You know how Gail Gordon can explode and things like that. Well,
right.
It just, if all you're doing is sitting in the theater watching these people doing this, and I think it would be amazing to do that, you get a better reaction where we can be looking around or doing whatever while we're listening to these.
Yep. Right. I was following the story, and there was a big audience eruption of laughter, and it makes the listener go, well, what is happening?
Some individuals may be doing some things. I'm sure that some of them did play to the audience. I know that Eve Arden wasn't playing to the audience. I mean, necessarily like that. Yeah, I could see Phil Harris do it. I could see maybe Gail Gordon doing it too. I mean, when he's doing all that blustering and yelling and stuff, you know,
right.
Yeah, you got to get a little excited to do that, which is funnier.
Mm-hmm.
Red Skelton would oftentimes talk to his audience. He break that fourth wall on the show on radio and television. And so there were some instances where they were playing to the audience in particular, but most of it was going through the script that they had in hand. You don't hear that. Of course, they didn't have studio mics up, but The Shadow, even in the 50s, had a live audience, and they never turned the mics on until after it was all over and everybody was applauding. But there were people in a live audience watching shows like The Shadow as well.
So we missed out on all that grand laughter during The Shadow. I got you.
Yeah, all the grand laughter on The Shadow. But, no.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
there you go. That's the best I can do for you. But that is way
it
was.
Answer. Yes.
Yeah. Let's drink a little.
Go ahead,
Dave. I haven't found any other reflection other than what Dave said anywhere in any writings on the grand interwebs. So that was kind of a good one.
Yep. We got a little bit more with Gail Gordon here. Do we want to do a caller yet, Dave, or are we going to save those for tomorrow?
Yeah, let's do a caller. He at the end of the program, or the last half hour of the interview, they took calls from people in Chicago or wherever they were and talking directly to Gail Gordon, asking him questions. Go ahead and take your caller. That's cool.
Gail Gordon.
Yes, sir.
I like that one show where you played a banker, Mr. Mooney, and the floor opened and Lucy fell in.
Ah, yes.
That was so funny.
Yes. That was almost a tragedy, too, because that trap door, when we were filming, the cable broke, and we weren't just let down through the floor. We actually fell about 10 feet and almost shook our teeth loose. We landed on the ground with a terrible jolt, and Lucy's main concern was that there was a man, the special effects man, underneath the stage who was controlling the cable, and her first thought was that maybe we'd crushed his leg or his foot, and that she was very concerned about him. She didn't care about herself, and she knew I was all right. We were both standing there. But while the audience was applauding and laughing at that going through the floor, we were trying to make sure that the man underneath, the special effects man, hadn't been very badly injured. And nobody knew it. The show ended and the audience left, and we were pulled up, and so was the man, the special effects man, not hurt at all, thank God. But it was a very near thing, and those are things that happen that the audience never realizes.
Well, it was really interesting.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Gail, let me ask you, did you do most of your own stunts on those shows?
All of them.
You did them
so
all.
So did Lucy. She never had a double do anything for her. Never. We couldn't. Well, there was an audience within 25, 30 feet of the set. We filmed it in front of an audience. You couldn't have a double walk on because everyone would have seen it.
Mm-hmm.
No, and Lucy, of course, no matter what she had to do, she learned how to do it, and she did it beautifully. If she had to walk on stilts, she learned how to do it and did it. And if she had to roller skate, she roller skated, and it was better than most people after years and years of constantly doing it. She was a perfectionist in every way. She worked harder than anybody in the show, and she expected other people to work hard, and that's one of the things I admired about her and loved her for, because she was not satisfied with second best at all. It had to be perfect or don't do it.
And that's why those shows lasted all those years,
through these years.
There you go, with the phone call and a little more of the Chuck Shaden interview.
Yeah, and so we could, if we get in there and finish this show up, I bet you we have a little bit more time for at least one more clip of something.
Yep. Let's wrap up. Armis Brooks.
Get ready for some laughter.
Yuck.
You'll never hear us here in the boiler room, Harry. It's not a chance. Believe me.
But are you sure, Walter?
Well, just to play it absolutely safe, I'll test. Ah, come on, Harriet, give me a kiss. Just one little kiss. Yeah, it's okay, Harriet. If he'd heard me, his bark would have exploded the boiler room by this time. Now, what do you think of my plan?
Well, making a hero of Daddy in front of Mr. Stone sounds pretty fantastic to me.
Fantastic? What's fantastic about it? It's simple. When Mr. Stone tries out the sound system and contacts the boiler room, I pretend the water pipes have exploded and I'm practically drowning.
And then Daddy hears you hollering, dashes down and rescues you, huh?
Yeah, that's the idea. Now, that could be... Harriet, I just got a terrible thought.
What?
If your father ever really thought I was drowning, he'd let me.
While making a hero of Mr. Conklin in front of Mr. Stone seemed like an ideal way to get him his promotion, particularly if it occurred while he was demonstrating his new amplifying system. However, unknown to each other, Miss Brooks and Walter Denton happened to get the idea at the same time. So as Miss Brooks approached her principal's office that afternoon, she knew nothing of the mix-up.
Miss Brooks, just a moment, please.
Why, Mr. Conklin, I was just about to stop in your office on my way home. Can you hear all right now?
I can hear all right, but my head feels like the inside of the Holland Tunnel at high noon. However, let's forget the boiler room caper, shall we? Now listen, I have a favor to ask of you, a big favor. Mr. Stone is in my office at this very moment, and I'm about to demonstrate my amplifying system to him.
Oh, I wouldn't worry about getting that promotion anymore, sir. Accidents have a way of happening at the strangest times, making heroes of the strangest people. I have a feeling one may happen very soon.
Why, Miss Brooks, how did you find out about the accident I'd planned?
You planned an accident?
And you will play a key role in it.
What are you going to do, push me off the roof?
Oh, what a perfectly delightful... Miss Brooks, this accident again involves an open elevator shaft. If you look 10 feet in front of you, the shaft is open.
Oh, no, sir, not again. Don't ask me to do it again. My fingertips are all worn out.
We've got to act quickly. I've made arrangements with our home economics teacher, Miss Miller, to cling from that open elevator shaft in exactly 2 minutes. At that time, or before, you will come into my office screaming for help, and I shall bound to the rescue.
Oh, well, before you go, sir, we'd better synchronize our accident. You see,
Worry about Miss Miller. Even if she does let go, it's only a 4-foot drop, and I have several mattresses underneath to break her fall.
But, sir, believe me, it won't be necessary.
Do as I say, Miss Brooks. Give me a moment or two with Mr. Stone, and then go into your act.
But, Mr. Conklin,
there you are, Conklin. Say, this is quite an efficient-looking acoustical setup you've got here.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Stone. Well, it's only natural for a principal whose only concern is his school to want to improve its operation. And as you know, sir, in all my years at this school, my one thought, my one aim has been how I can become assistant super... How I can... better conditions here at Madison.
I'm well aware of that, Osgood. But now I'd like to hear this amplifying system in operation, so...
Miss Conklin, come quickly. Something terrible has happened. Miss Miller has fallen down the elevator shaft. She's clinging to the ledge this very minute.
What? Fallen down the elevator shaft? Good heavens. Why, Miss Brooks, it happened to you only yesterday.
Yes, sir. I must have ushered in the season.
Well, what are we standing around for? A human life is in peril. Clear, quick, decisive action is called for. And if there's one thing about Osgood Conklin, he is never one to lose his head in emergencies and turn his...
Conklin! Stop filibustering and save her.
Yes, at once.
This is terrible, Miss Brooks, simply terrible. I think we'd better contact someone to give Conklin a hand.
But how could we contact anyone in time for him to do any good, sir?
I could try using the amplifying system.
I withdraw the question.
Exactly. It's only a little after 3. Some teachers must still be in their classrooms. Mr. Boynton usually stays late to work in his lab, doesn't he? Maybe he can lend a hand.
Oh, no, sir. I've been trying to borrow one for years. I'm certain he's gone home.
Well, nevertheless, there's no harm in trying the biology lab. Now, where is that button? Oh, yeah, here we are.
Help, Mr. Conklin, save me. Please save me. These poison gas fumes are choking me. Help me.
Something's happened to Boynton. What's going on down there?
Sounds like the deathbed scene from Camille.
Save me, Mr. Conklin. A test tube exploded and I'm choking. Please save me, Mr. Conklin.
Conklin's out on call, Mr. Boynton. Will I do?
Quick action, Miss Brooks. The boiler room is the closest place to the biology lab. I'll contact the school custodian. Oh, yes, here's the button.
Help! Save me, Mr. Conklin! No.
Sounds like Walter Denton, and he's drowning?
When those water pipes go, they really go.
Oh, save me, Mr. Conklin! Save me!
Miss Brooks, just why is everyone all over the school calling for Osgood Conklin?
Maybe Philip Morris is busy.
Sir, I'm sure that's what you heard.
What I heard is plenty. It's all beginning to add up, Miss Brooks.
Well, maybe if you subtracted those last 2 accidents.
Well, I saved Miss Miller. She almost pulled me down into the shaft with her, but I broke her death hold on my ankle and pulled her up by the hair. But it was actually nothing. Nothing at all.
I agree with you.
Eh?
You feel quite the hero, don't you, Conklin? Then suppose you get your rescue squad and save this poor soul.
Oh, save me, Mr. Conklin! The poison gas! Gas all over! Save me!
Where's Mr. Boynton? I rushed right
Hold
down.
Hold it, Rover boy. We have another customer for you in the boiler room.
Probably going down for the 3rd time.
Save me, Mr. Conklin! I'm drowning! I'm going down for the 15th time!
Okay, so shoot me.
But I don't understand. What are they all doing? Miss Brooks, why are they all yelling for me to save them?
I don't know, sir, unless they're mistaking you for a Saint Bernard.
Believe me, Mr. Stone, I had no hand in all this. I'm an innocent man.
Do we have any more accidents waiting for us, Conklin?
I thought all we had on the calendar for today, sir.
Why, innocent, Mr. Stone, believe me.
Here we have a button marked Ruth. What little game are we playing up there, Conklin?
Oh, nothing, sir. Absolutely nothing. That's for emergency air raid spotting.
Well, we'll try it anyway, shall we?
Save me, Osgood, for goodness sake. Save me.
Margaret Davis? But what's she doing on the roof?
Miss Brooks?
Don't ask me, sir. I'm still trying to figure out Walter.
Save me, Osgood. I'm stuck on the television aerial. Save me, Osgood. My hero. Save me.
I think I've heard enough. Conklin, I don't know whether to bring charges against you or just continue to tolerate your occasional lapses into complete idiocy. But one thing is certain. Neither you nor Jason Brill will be recommended for that promotion.
Neither one of them?
No, Miss Brooks. And don't try to tell me now that you didn't stage that Perils of Pauline act yesterday, too.
Mr. Stone, that's not true. I had a real accident, and I earned every bruise of it.
Honestly, Miss Brooks, at this point, I don't know whether to believe anyone has had any real accidents or not. So, good day to both of you.
Well, at least Brill won't get the job.
Oh! Help!
What was that? Now, isn't that a shame? Shall we, Miss Brooks?
I knew if we kept on pitching, sir, we'd make it sometime today.
Martin, transcribed, was produced and directed by Lalu Derman, with the music of Lud Gluskin. Mr. Conklin was played by Gail Gordon. Others in tonight's cast were Jane Morgan, Dick Crenna, Bob Rockwell, Gloria McMillan, and Joseph Kearns.
Yo, with Miss Brooks. I love it when she comes back each and every time. And, of course, today we're celebrating Gail Gordon's Boy Day.
Happy Boy's Day, almost, Gail.
Vanna White also has a birthday today, I understand.
And sooner or later, this week. Sooner or later, so, everyone has
so
a
I wonder who turns her letters.
Whoa. I'd like to turn her letters.
Just wondering.
Harvey Korman also had a birthday this week on the 15th.
He was a great character actor as well.
He was. And I think we got some time. Well, we do have plenty of time left there.
We got tons of time. We got nothing but time.
Do we have a moral on a comedy? You betcha.
We do. Yeah.
Why wouldn't we? Eerie House Radio proudly presents a comedic, yet Gar's moral of the story.
An accident can happen anytime. A planned accident requires more start time.
But as Dave
Gail, mentioned, do you recall
lots of time.
An actress by the name of Yvonne Romaine?
Romaine?
Did she own a lettuce
Let
farm
us
or something?
Let us examine this. I do not recall her.
Does Curse of the Werewolf do anything for you?
That's not a bad movie.
Yeah, it makes me want to hide in the closet.
I mean, she was in it.
She was one of the victims. And it's her birthday this week as well. 84 years old.
And still with us.
And still with us, to the best of my knowledge. Yes.
That's cool. That's cool.
That's cool, yeah.
Cool.
More interview with Gail Gordon.
Yeah, let's get a little Burns and Allen into it too as we play part four of the interview with Chuck Shaden.
Gail, you remember those days with fondness working with Lucy on radio?
Oh yes. Always a joy working with her in no matter what media.
Did you work with her at all in the original I Love Lucy TV shows?
Yes. Yes, I did two or three of them.
Mm-hmm.
Not as any established character. I played the owner of the nightclub where Ricky worked on one occasion. And I don't know, I did another appearance on one of them, but by that time I was doing Miss Brooks, so it was rather difficult. Only once in a while I could do her show.
It was Miss Brooks that virtually the entire cast of the radio version of Our Miss Brooks moved to television, didn't it?
That's right. The entire cast, with the exception of Jeff Chandler,
mm-hmm.
who became a movie star during the radio run of Our Miss Brooks. And when we moved over into television, Universal wouldn't let him appear in the television show because he was signed to star at Universal Pictures.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was when they got...
Robert Rockwell, I think.
Bob Rockwell,
yeah,
dear mm-hmm. sweet man, yes.
That was a marvelous series, and gosh, you did so much to enhance that and to make it entertaining for all of us over the years with... Actually, my whole life, radio and television, you've been there. And I think I speak for so many people, too, that you've entertained so royally.
Well, that's very nice to hear.
Your list of radio credits is like is like an encyclopedia of radio. You were on the Great Gildersleeve program.
Yes.
As a more or less a regular on there. You were Gildy's neighbor on that show.
Yes.
That was Bullard, wasn't it, Mr. Bullard?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You probably can't even recall half of the shows that you were on over all those years.
Well, no, I was Irene Rich's leading man for 9 years for Welsh's Grape Juice. I was also, most people don't know, I was Mary Pickford's leading man for a year in a series that she had on radio. And with Joey Brown... And Phil Harris, I was on their show, and of course I was with Burns and Allen for 2 or 3 seasons. And I was very, very lucky to work with some wonderful, wonderful people.
Tell us about Burns and Allen. You played an interesting character on that show. You played a Texan, didn't you?
Yes, yes. Tex Judson, his name was. His characteristic was every time he stubbed his toe, up came another darned oil well, and he was just rolling in money. And what he adored about Gracie was her sense of humor, and she'd open her mouth, and he'd fall over and just scream with laughter. And it was a delightful character to do, and I had a lot of fun doing it. And I still see George every year once in a while. We have the same barber. We've been going to the same barber for 35 years, I guess. So I see George there every once in a while now, and we say hello and talk over old times. They were delightful people to work with, just wonderful.
Well, the magic of radio finds us with another little clip. This is just about a 2.5-minute clip of you with George and Gracie in a broadcast from 1947, actually. In this particular case, Gracie, who is always conniving to promote George, she wants Bing Crosby to retire so that George can take his place. And so we have George and Gracie and Bing and yourself as Mr. Judson.
Uh-huh.
So let's listen together for a few seconds.
Okay.
You know, Luella might differ with me, but I don't think this kid is quite ready for pictures.
Oh, look, here comes our friend Mr. Judson. We'll ask his opinion about you retiring.
Who's Judson?
Oh, a big oil millionaire from Texas. Mm. Come in.
Howdy, little lady. Howdy, Burns.
Hello, Mr.
Hello,
Judson.
Hello, Mr. Judson.
Oh, I'd like you to meet our friend, Bing Crosby.
Bing Crosby? Say, I'm proud to shake your hand. I admire your singing. I admire your acting. You're a mighty celebrated man.
Thank you, sir.
And what part of Texas are you from?
No, I'm not a Texan.
Oh, now you must be kidding. A famous man like you just can't be a foreigner.
However, I hail from the happy little hamlet of Spokane, Washington.
Now, where at is that?
That's about 1,000 miles due north.
Oh, doggone, that's hard luck. Just over the Texas border.
Mr. Judson, we'd like your opinion on something. Do you think Bing Crosby should retire?
Well, would you like to, Bing?
Well, it wouldn't be bad to settle down to a little serious golf.
No, that sounds right good. Doctor out here advised me to take up that game for my health, so I went and bought myself 3 golf clubs.
Only 3? Which clubs did you buy?
Lakeside, Hillcrest, and the Hollywood Country Club.
I'm in the league,
you have?
Well, that's a good beginning.
Yeah, yeah. Now, say, if you do retire, Bing, I'd admire to have you visit me on my ranch. Of course, it ain't much as ranches go in Texas.
How big a patch of ground you got?
Well, I don't rightly know. I sent some fellas out to survey it 10 years ago, and they ain't done yet.
Sounds a bit cramped, don't it?
Yeah, but I got some real fine horses on it. Say, seems to me like I read you used to own some horses yourself.
Well, it's always been a moot question. I can only say they went by that name. They had four legs, some of them, that is.
Yeah. Well, now, I guarantee you'd like these cow ponies of mine.
Cow ponies?
Yep, yep.
Well, what a wonderful combination. You can ride them and milk them, too.
You can ride...
And again, Gail Gordon, he, all over the place. Burns and Allen, Timber McGee and Molly, My Favorite Husband.
Great Gildersleeve, yeah, My Favorite Husband. He's, like you said, he started in about 1933 and has never been out of work as an actor.
Amazing. And we got more of them tomorrow with Granby's Green Acres, Flash Gordon, and more of these phone interviews and phone calls. I hear George Jensen.
Yep. Yeah, he's trying to check in, but...
He just landed. Yep, so that's tomorrow at 6:30 Eastern. And then, I don't know, say the show ends, I don't know, around 8 o'clock. I wonder what one could do then.
If things go well, Horrible Horror starring Gar the Ghoul will be on Twitch. And you'll have to go to Facebook to figure out all that. Gar the Ghoul on Twitch, and you'll find out.
Twitch.
Yeah, Gordon was also in quite a few of the Lux Radio theaters. Alice in Wonderland, Samson Delilah, a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, we got more coming, and... It's good fodder for another drive-in.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. All kinds of great movies that radio dramatized. Somehow, some of them knocked it down to half an hour.
Yeah.
Of course, most of the movies, a lot of movies then weren't much more than 65, 68 minutes long. So.
Yeah.
He was also in Blackstone, the Magic Detective, which might be a little eerie. Not really sure.
Who was
a bunch of Lux. Wow. Yes, he was in, where was that? Blackstone, 1949, Message from Nowhere, Riddle of the Rose, Missing Palmist. He was just, there's another one. Cabinet.
Hey, as we were honoring some folks who had birthdays around now, along with Gail Gordon, Rob Smith brought up Rico Browning, turned 92 this past weekend.
Yep.
One of the original players of the Creature from the Black Lagoon. Scuba
some
diver.
Information says he's the last surviving Gill man, actually.
I would think so, because, I don't know, is Julie Adams still around? Julie Adams was doing a lot of conventions into her 90s.
Yeah. Let's see. Browning was inducted into a Florida Artist Hall of Fame in 2012. Rick Browning?
10 years ago. Okay.
He was in... Creature in the Black Lagoon, Revenge of the Creature, and The Creature Walks Among Us. He was the only actor to have portrayed the creature more than once. And according to some indicators, it says he's the only surviving Gillman actor, not person in the movies. Where you have the Julia.
Time is a waste, and I want to thank everybody, GGSI Paper, good old Bob, Rob Smith Jr., and, of course, Fogs Bane, for joining us tonight. We'll be back tomorrow at 6:30 Eastern. And, of course, you know you're going to check out Gar the Ghoul when we're done at 8. See you tomorrow.
The castle lights are growing dim. There's no one left but me and him.
And him.
When next we meet in Frankenstone, don't come alone.
That was timed perfectly. Quite by accident, but perfectly.
There you go.
The boing is always on.
And the goat.
Yeah.
You're too serious, Gar. I got to do something about that.
Eeny, meeny, chili beanie. The spirits are about to speak.
I've had a very long, long day. I'm actually going to pass out very soon.
I had that day like 3 days ago. The dog decided he wanted to party all night.
They do make Dramamine for animals. It's safe. You can do that.
I don't want to drug my
animals. Knock them right out.
I don't like drugging animals. That's not right.
I agree. Now, sometimes it's needed. I mean, sometimes.
Save it for the human.
All the dogs I've ever had in the last 20 years, I've had two, never did that. And they enjoyed a car ride. It was fun, exciting, you know. And if they got bored, they'd lay down and take a nap or whatever. But I never had to do that.
I
think for the cats.
Yeah.
For the cats, we had to use a little bit of something. One of the cats was just, I don't know, it had behavioral problems.
I had one sulky cat, Miss Gray, was very, antisocial. Only animal I ever had like that was antisocial.
We've had two cats like that, but again, all of our cats have been abandoned or rescued, so...
Bless you for taking them in.
There's some memories that always stick with them. And Inky Binky Boo, we still have him, and he's just the world's biggest scaredy cat, except for one Carib Bear. That was an even bigger scaredy cat than Inky Binky Boo.
We had kind of a schizophrenic beer type cat, and I think it attacked my significant other once when we were on a walk. Just lost its mind. It was like, wow, what the heck? Yeah. And again, it's a weird thing. I was talking with someone earlier this week who's having a feline with a cancer thing where the doctors say, well, we've got medication, but it's just a matter of time. And it reminded me that the last two dogs I had, both of them, ended up with this weird brain tumor circumstance that happens in dogs. And it would elicit this unfounded fight or flight reflex. Uh-huh. Now, with my dogs, it was always a flight thing. They would get scared of things that, one of them was afraid of the water bowl out of nowhere. It was like,
oh, gee.
Okay.
You sure there wasn't rabies?
No. It was the tumor.
Hydrophobia. What do I
know? No, it was the tumor.
I'm not a vet.
It was a brain tumor. And so what I would do is I would console them, and then eventually they would calm down, and we would going against their own chemistry, which the tumor was kicking off all kinds of weird chemicals in their brain. So it was difficult. We did still have good times, but a lot of it was, calming them down and being very patient, and it would overcome with that. But
anybody who's kind to animals has a warm spot in my heart, and that's one thing I like about both of you guys very much.
Mm-hmm.
I think it speaks volumes.
I would love the opportunity to get another skunk in my lifetime. That would be so cool.
Never too late.
Maybe.
There's me.
I wouldn't mind getting a couple of skunks. Actually, I wouldn't mind a brood of skunks. Wall to wall skunks.
Just get married. Just get married.
Yeah.
It's cheaper to have skunks, pal. I got to tell you.
Yeah. And they probably don't smell as bad.
Well, you know. See, the good thing about a skunk is you can wash a skunk. So.
True.
If your wife stinks, I don't know what to tell you. Yeah, I don't know.
Only the first one stinks. Always remember, only the first wife stinks.
Yes.
I didn't have that problem.
Why don't we just go straight to the second wife in life? Why is that?
For the same reason we don't start with our grandkids.
I don't have one yet. No fair.
For the same reason we don't start with grandkids, you know?
Well, you have to put down, there's a little bit of pre-planning in that. A little bit. Yeah.
A little bit.
Oh, what was it? Oh, just for you guys to know, tomorrow when you listen to Granby's Green Acres, the moral is never judge a window box by its farmer. That's the moral. So have that running around your brain when you hear it. There you go.
Now my head's going to hurt until then. Maybe more after. I don't know.
I didn't have one for Flash Gordon. It's Flash Gordon. What are you going to do with Flash Gordon? I don't know. But I had one for that other one. Well, I am going to cut out of here. I'm wiped out. My washing machine died. I got to go get another one of those. Probably won't be able to do it until Sunday. Migraine hit me. I went to the racetrack. That helped. I might have to go back to the racetrack tomorrow morning. I don't know.
Racetrack?
What's going on with that.
Is that where your doctor works out of the racetrack?
Yeah.
I've got from Fangmark Pharmaceuticals, I've got some Brazilian mule headache tablets, and so I have to go to the racetrack to get.
Oh, gotcha. I was a little slow on the uptake there.
On the box, the tagline is, it's a kick in the head. Yeah, so it's a great bit of medication there.
I hope it works.
Yep.
It
seems like it worked somewhat. I'm still really exhausted, though. I don't know if that's the medication or just a rough day.
Probably a combination
nothing
thereof.
Works. Could be. You know, and that's why they make these can't frickin' see. Okay, I cannot frickin' see.
Isn't that what you do to a chicken?
What?
Isn't that what you do to a chicken? Frickin' see them?
Frickin' see them?
Yeah.
Could be.
It has not affected your musical talent.
I know, it's still not there, is it?
I didn't want to say that part.
Oh, I'll say it. I'll be the first one to say it. You can be the second. You know. It's just a noisemaker until you arrange it correctly, I guess. I don't know. So, how about we chime out with some cowbell and Jimmy Durante, and I'll talk to you guys
and
later.
Jimmy Durante.
Yeah.
All right, sir. Come on up.
Oh, large schnozzled one.
Schnoz.
Yeah, that one. That guy.
Sit your butt down by the piano.
Good night.
Good night, guys. Good night, Dale.
What more is this say but good night? We've had a few laughs, and it's time for toodaloo. Arrivo, up we the same, and ink-a-tink-a-doo. Good night.
Toodles!
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night, folks. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Wherever.
Eeny, meeny, chili beanie, the spirits are about to speak.